Hello, and welcome to the Classicist Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, here with Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ilya Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, I want to turn to foreign policy today and to the two countries that probably loom largest for the U.S. as we're sizing up the globe, China and Russia. And as you point out in a piece that you wrote recently for American Greatness, these are two countries that have occupied our attention for a long time. And we should probably start this conversation and this story with Henry Kissinger, because as you point out in this piece, Kissinger had an answer for how we handled both countries, both in terms of our interests and vis-a-vis each other. So explain for the audience what that was and what the consequences were.
Well, under Kissinger's detente dash triangulation, I think that he summed it up in his memoir that the United States would seek to achieve an equilibrium in which China did not and Russia did not feel that they were closer to either of those, either one of the two, than they were with the United States. So we would want to have a situation in which all three powers' points on the triangle would be the same, and then one power would always be worried about the other two ganging up on them. In those days, because Russia was so much more powerful, it meant to undercut Russia, the Soviets, by reaching out to Mao or his successors. Now, the inverse is true, that China is much more powerful than the former Soviet Union-Russia, so we should, under the Kissinger protocol, we should be reaching out to Russia on matters of Iran or the Middle East or North Korea to stymie China. But we've lost that point of the triangle because of the so-called collusion narrative the last 2 years and the demonization of Russia. And I think it'd be wise that we start to look at as Putin, not as an ally, but something like Joseph Stalin during this World War II, where we used him or he used us or whatever. You look at the relationship to balance off against Nazi Germany. We could do that with China and China vice versa with Putin, but we've sort of have a self-inflicted wound by alienating that theory of triangulation.
Now, you identify the Obama administration as the point at which we really sort of lost the thread on both of these countries. Explain where you think President Obama went wrong and what resulted from that.
Well, it could be the overall doctrine was you would lecture people about their supposed ethical or moral shortcomings. So our ambassador to Russia always was telling Putin that he was not democratic, he was not liberal, he was not humane, and he wasn't. And we did the same thing finally with China. We said, oh, you know, you shouldn't do that with the Spratly Islands, and you should remember Tiananmen Square, and let's not bully Taiwan, and can't you be helpful on North Korea? But, you know, you're really illiberal, and you'd be much better off to get on the arc of history that always bends in a moral direction that where we are. The problem with that approach is that they projected at the same time weakness. So when Putin in 2014 went into Crimea and Ukraine, or he started doing cyber attacks, or he threatened us to our missile defense pact with Eastern Europe, we just backed down. That was what reset was. It was to accommodate Putin. The same thing with China. They were running up almost a $400 billion trade surplus by expropriating U.S. technology, violating patent law and copyright law, dumping materials below the cost of production in the world commercial markets and trade. And yet we didn't do anything. So it was sort of, I don't know, talk loudly and carry a twig. And that doesn't work very well in high-stakes diplomacy.
Okay, so if we take this up to the present day, I want to actually take these countries one at a time in terms of the policy considerations, but why don't we even start at a more foundational level? Victor, how do these countries think of themselves? What can we confidently say about Russia's ambitions or confidently say about China's ambitions?
Well, they're very different. I think Russia realizes that with the breakup of the Soviet Empire, that it's now an ethnic nation, an Orthodox religious nation, and it's not going to be a multiracial, huge empire of different races and ethnic groups all united by Marxist-Leninism. And so it's much smaller. Population is about a third smaller. It's more cohesive. And it has 6,500 nuclear weapons that it inherited from the Soviet Union. So that's its main... And it's the second largest oil producer. With take away oil and nukes, and it's not much. But with oil and nukes, it's a player. It's not a superpower. It doesn't really have a blue water navy. It doesn't really have an impressive economy. It's a small economy. It's got a lot of existential crisis, especially demographic. So it's a regional power, and what it wants to do is play a role that the Soviet Union did beyond its borders in the Middle East or in Asia, and it doesn't really have the ability to do anything other than to thwart the United States in its region, you know, not in Latin America, not in Africa, not all over the world, but maybe along the borders of Eastern Europe or in Ukraine or in the Baltic states. And then it's much different than China. China is like the old Soviet Union. It has ambitions. It has a billion-plus population. It's got nuclear weapons. It's got the second-largest economy in the world. And its ambitions are to emulate the antithesis to the United States that the Soviet Union did. So I always have compared it to the Japanese Empire, the Greater Asia co-prosperity sphere of the late 1930s and early 1940s. In which Japan sought to unite Asians against European colonialists and sort of a mercantile system to the benefit of Japan. And that's sort of what China is saying to Korea, the Philippines, Southeast Asians, Indonesians, and former republics of the Soviet Union. We're all Asians, and we're going to build transportation, communications, trade blocks, and we can thwart these Americans that are foreigners that are neo-imperialist or colonialist. And I don't think it's working very well, just like the Japanese effort didn't work well because it was Asians wanted to be closer to the United States, which they felt was not as racist as another Asian power like Japan. I think people resent China more than they do the United States, that is, Asians do.
How central is it to Chinese ambitions to knock the U.S. off of its pedestal? I mean, you can get plenty paranoid real quickly when you start digging into the details of the cyber operations, for instance, about what they might be willing to do to us. But are the Chinese ambitions contingent on actually inflicting affirmative harm to the U.S., or would they just be just as satisfied if we just sort of pulled back as a global player?
Well, I think we'd have to listen to what they say in their latest Communist Congress. President Xi said essentially that they were first going to be a regional power, then they were going to achieve technological parity with us, then I think it was in 20 years they would be militarily superior. In their way of thinking, now that they have the largest country in the world, and population-wise, bigger than India, and that they have nuclear weapons, and now they've adopted a capitalist mode of production, more or less, and they're running up these huge trade surpluses, not just with us, but with the world at large. They feel that the future is theirs. And they can't understand why the United States, it's a much smaller, third the size, should bow out. What they can't calibrate, or they can calibrate it, but they don't want to process it because it's antithetical to their political system, is that even now, the United States, with one-third the population, has almost, depending on how we calibrate the GDP, in some ways, double the economy. So one U.S. worker is really producing twice as much goods and services as three Chinese workers. We have a much more sophisticated and larger military. We lead the world in high tech. We have most of the world's top universities are in the United States. Our demographic is... profile is anemic, but not as anemic as China, which is an aging society with its one-child policy. We're a multiracial society with immigration. Chinese are sort of a racist, monolithic society, and they're not tapping the full potential of their people because of coercion, censorship, political repression. So they can't quite figure out that they're sort of hyper-capitalist, and they're authoritarian, and they've got all these advantages, but they can't quite ever reach us. And I think what's happening is they're starting to play the role that right after in the 40s they said, you know, the Soviet system is better than the American system, we will bury you. And then when that didn't happen, it was sort of the Japanese are going to bury us in the 1970s and early 80s, that crony capitalist model. And then when that didn't happen, we were told the EU and soft power and no borders and kind of a postmodern government is going to bury us. And that didn't happen. And I think the Chinese are now the next fad, that their paradigm is going to bury us. And we always are much more resilient. And we're going to have a higher GDP than they are. We produce more energy than they do. We have, you know, every category we have an advantage. And I don't think they can process that.
Let's talk about these countries in the context of the current administration. President Trump has come in for a lot of criticism on Russia. Even apart from the collusion narrative, there's this whole school of thought that the president is soft on Vladimir Putin, that he pulls his punches where the Russians are concerned. How much credence do you give to that, and what do you make of the president's relationship with Moscow so far?
Well, it's completely false, because we just look at what's happening and not what's being said. Trump has an art of the deal a methodology in which he's really tough, and then he tries to leave open a window of negotiation by being rhetorically empathetic. He does that with North Korea. We have the toughest sanctions we've ever had on North Korea. We have allies on board. We're racing ahead with sophisticated missile defense. We have cyber attacks probably going against the North Korean missile program. And yet he talks now in friendly terms to Kim Jong-un. He's doing the same thing with Putin. Nobody in the past armed the Ukrainians like Trump did. Nobody had as tough as sanctions as Trump did. Nobody has increased the defense budget in recent memory as much as Trump did. Nobody has galvanized NATO, whether you like the manner in which he did it. He's going to get them to contribute more money, and that's aimed at Putin than Trump did. And Trump is, you know, he's with Keystone and the Anwar and his energy policy. We're the largest gas, oil, and coal producer in the world, and Putin doesn't like that. So I think what he's trying to say to all of us is, let's not rub Putin's snout in the ground, but otherwise don't trust him and praise him to the heavens while we tighten the noose around his neck. And Obama, again, was once in a while to be petulant with Putin and then not do anything at all to him.
Now, I don't think anybody particularly accuses the president of being soft on China. In fact, the criticism you usually hear there is that he's too strident and that he's playing with fire when it comes to the tariff regime, that he could imperil Chinese willingness to help the U.S. deal with North Korea. How do you judge the state of play with China, and how would you like to see it go forward in the future?
Yeah, I think it was pretty incoherent. So under George W. Bush and under Barack Obama, there was two pillars of our policy. And one is we just sort of shrugged and said, you know, they're bigger than we are and they're working harder and they're rebuilding their society ex nihilo. So their trajectory is going to be a superpower that we can't, and it's just going to happen. And let's try to adjust to it. And then the twin of that was, but we shouldn't worry about that, because the wealthier they get, the more Western technology they steal, the more their students are trained in Europe, the United States, the more liberal they're going to be. And I think both of those were fallacious, both the pessimism and the optimism, i.e., it was not fated that they were going to be more powerful than we are, and I think we're seeing that now. Our GDP, not the phony GDP figures that China issues, but the real GDP is going to be more anemic than ours, and energy-wise, it's not even close. And in terms of real unemployment, it's not close. Our economy is just much more versatile and flexible and fluid than theirs is. And then there's no evidence whatsoever that they use Western liberality and patience or forbearance to become more liberal. They become more autocratic. And when they come back, their students don't say, wow, let's be like the United States necessarily. It's, wow, they're kind of decadent, and we don't want to be like them, and sort of like fundamentalist Islamicists. So I just don't think the prior policy was very logical, and now it's changing. But one final comment, if you want to change it and make China play by the rules of international commerce and not have a $400 billion trade surplus that's based on violating copyrights and patents and dumping and technological infringement, then what do you do? What levers do you have in a nation's arsenal? The only one you have is a tariff, short of war. And so I think Trump feels that he doesn't like tariffs, but it's a tool, and that they'll blink before we do, and then they'll come in and say, okay, we went up a $400 billion trade surplus with you. Why don't we cut it down to $300? And they're going to horse trade over what the number would be. Won't be zero, but it will be a lot better than $400 billion.
All right. Thanks to our listeners for tuning in. Remember, you can read Victor's work at definingideas at hoover.org, as well as at victorhansen.com. And if you enjoy The Classicist, please rate the show on iTunes. For Victor Davis Hansen, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.